So, for those that don't know, or aren't familiar with Austin and in particular, what Batbridge is, give us a little bit of history with this company and why they made you a creative director. It seems insane.
Well, Batbridge was formed in September of 2013. And it was a group of people that had all worked together at other production companies in and around Austin. And right off the bat, our first project that we developed, we ended up selling to CNN. It was an 8-part documentary called High Profits. And that sale to CNN kind of set us on this trajectory of just doing, premium content for premium networks. It was after that experience that I think everybody agreed, look, like if we can actually be lucky enough to make this work and just do really good stories for great networks and avoid reality TV, that's what we were trying to do. So I'm lucky that I get to work with some incredibly talented and creative people at Batbridge, and we've been able to do some cool projects.
How does working with places like CNN, HBO, Showtime, how does that change the way you approach the ideas that you want to showcase to us?
Well, the good thing about working with those networks are that they appreciate story and they understand story. So it makes it a lot easier in communicating what it is that we want to do, and it gives us a lot more room to kind of dive into the context that we love. Because that's the best part about telling a story in long form, right? Is that you can provide an extra layer, multiple layers of context and detail to something that you wouldn't be able to do at a lot of other networks and a lot of other formats. And it's different with CNN because they still have their six act structure and their advertising model. And that's tricky. That can be tricky to tell a story in a six act structure like that. It's a lot easier to work on premium platforms or subscription-based networks like HBO and Showtime, because you don't have to think about, okay, we got 6 minutes in this act that we have to get to an in and an out point every 6 minutes or 7 minutes. That can be really challenging when you're working with a network that does advertising and commercial breaks.
Does that mean that High Profits and the radical story of Patty Hearst, you have so much footage you weren't able to use?
Yeah. We try to be as efficient as possible. I think most of the time we are, but yeah, it gets very, very difficult when you have to work around commercial breaks, because you're struggling with how abrupt can this be before we go out to a break and coming into a break. And you really have to work. It's very, very difficult to get that right flow with the story and something like that. So yeah, we always overshoot, but we try to be as efficient as we possibly can.
I've got to ask, you wear so many different hats. I mean, you're not just a director, but you've produced so much material as well, with different producing, executive, co-executive, field producer back in the day with Shipping Wars. I'm curious. I remember in college the way you approached a college film. I think you storyboarded that poker movie like I've never seen. It was incredible. No one in class was doing that. But how do you approach when you're a producer compared to when you're directing a project? Is it the same, Pat, or is it slightly different?
No, it's the same. It's the same. Look, every story that we try to tell, it's always different. And that changes story to story, but it's all the same. I'm lucky that I've gotten to, have the experience that I have, where I've gotten to wear many different hats and work just about every position you can in production. And I'm also lucky that I have people on my team at Batbridge that have done the same. So that lets us work pretty lean, and everybody knows how to do multiple roles, and they know how to do them very, very well. So it allows us to stay pretty lean, and it's why we're able to do big projects. But our company, I mean, there's seven of us total. So it's nice. I prefer to work with smaller crews. I think we can move faster. And, it's because I have a lot of other people at Badbridge that have done similar things that I have, where they've worked their way up the business and everybody's done multiple things. So, you know, there's no pretension there among the crew. We just all go in and get it done. And I think the work ultimately benefits when you can do that.
What about on a technical side, you know, choice of cameras, what you like to use, what you've used over the years, what you haven't used, you like to use? I'm curious, like, you know, what you guys shot on High Profits compared to Disgrace, compared to the Scheme. I mean, is it the same setup?
Yeah, pretty much. We're I love Reds. So we've shot primarily on Reds for every project that we've done at Badbridge.
Okay.
Now, we'll come in and supplement with, like, for High Profits, for instance, all of our car shots, we had car mounts with Panasonic GH4s that worked incredibly well. We also had a huge, like, Octo drone back then that had a GH4 on it, which also looked amazing. And, you know, some of the stuff that we've done previously were with the Sony A7Ss that are amazing in low light, you know, specifically for exterior night shooting, where the Reds, you know, previously were not able to do what we needed them to do. But we just got some brand new Reds. We got a Ranger, a Gemini, and a regular modular Gemini, and those look absolutely amazing in low light. So Reds have been good to us, man. I love the look of them. You got a lot of flexibility in your frame rate with the Red. The dynamic range is incredible, and they've actually proven to be really, really sturdy and really, really tough for us in the field, because we've definitely pushed them, and they've been super durable. So I love the Reds.
Very nice. So I know, like, okay, High Profits and the other CNN projects are dealing with stuff outside necessarily. I mean, it's national stories. It's outside of our Texas scope. But a film like Disgraced, where it's so connected to the community, how do you get the access? I mean, like, how did you get Dave Bliss to... I mean, that interview with Dave is insane. Like, how do you approach people so well? I've always been amazed at the access you've gotten.
We've been lucky. I mean, I think the majority of it is luck, and then the other thing is just being persistent. But, you know, getting Dave had just written a book. I got the book right away, read the book, and I called him up, and, you know, I was surprised that he answered right away. We ended up having, I think, a 20-minute conversation on the phone first. And I could tell he was open to it, but it took a while. We had to meet a few times face-to-face, and then we talked, you know, many times over the phone before he said yes. So the funny thing was, like, getting Dave Bliss for Disgraced wasn't that difficult. Getting Abar Rouse for Disgraced was unbelievably difficult. I worked on Abar for over 6 months before you said yes. Many, many phone conversations, many face-to-face meets, and it was, I don't think we could have told the story without either one of them. So in my eyes, they're equally important, and I was very lucky to get both of them, because Dave had done an interview, I think, since he had been fired from Baylor, and I don't think Abar had done an interview either since he got fired from Baylor. So, you know, look, I chalk that one up to luck, for sure.
Is it more enjoyable to, or not, enjoyable is probably not the best word choice, but let's say getting to interview Dave or Abar, how is that different compared to interviewing someone like Bill Carter, who you've known forever, and I would say that you consider him a friend, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's obviously a lot easier to do an interview with somebody you have a personal relationship with. you know, because you don't have to try to establish that trust. They know who you are, and you know, it's not like the dance that you kind of have to do, because, look, it's incredibly, the amount of trust that somebody puts in to allowing a stranger to you know, turn a bunch of lights on, mic them up, put a camera on them, and start asking them, in most cases, about the worst moment of their lives. You know, that's a really, really terrifying experience, I think, for most people. So I'm always amazed when people say yes. I never take that for granted at all. You know, the easiest thing for anybody to say is no. Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting in all of these stories, you know, I tell everybody, the pitch is kind of always the same. It's like, look, I want every perspective included here. And you know what? If you're not going to tell your story, somebody else is going to tell us for you. And that's completely true. I totally believe that. And for getting interviews with people that I don't know and don't have a relationship with, that's part of it. And then I think it's just spending time with them so they understand that, you know, my motivations are true. And, you know, we get to know each other a little bit and form some kind of a relationship. Even the people that say, yes, Gabby, that I've never really met before, even if we talk on the phone, I always try to meet them before the day that we do the interview. So the first time we meet face-to-face is not when, again, there's a crew and camera there, you know, because that's awkward, you know. So it takes effort, I think, to make people feel comfortable. And I think the results are always way better. When somebody's sitting in front of a camera and they're comfortable and it's like we're just having a conversation, that's where you really get great stuff.
I think this all leads up to the scheme and Christian. And tell me a bit about how this came about and how you did what you just said. How did you get his confidence?
Well, I got a call from Peter Nelson at HBO Sports. And we had talked about doing some other projects together in the past that just didn't work out. And he called me and said, hey, have you heard about this whole NCAA Christian Dawkins thing? I had, but I hadn't really looked into it after that big press conference because it seemed like nothing really happened with the story. And I didn't know much about Christian, so when he told me about Christian asking if I was interested, I just read every article, I think, that had ever been written that mentioned Christian. And then I got on the phone with him, and we had a conversation, and he was hilarious right off the bat. And that was in between his first and second federal trial. He had been found guilty already, but he hadn't been sentenced in the first trial. And then he still had a whole second trial that was kind of looming over him. And so I wanted to get out there and meet him face-to-face immediately because I wanted to shoot all of this in real time. I didn't want to interview him, you know, after this. If the sentence was nothing, a slap on the wrist, you know, it would totally skew his perspective of everything that happened. And if he got 10 years in prison, it would, you know, the same thing, it would skew it the other direction. So I wanted to get it in that moment of uncertainty. So I went out and saw him where he lived, and we spent 3 days together. And we had every meal together. We talked. I kind of shadowed him as he was doing his other work. And, you know, he said yes right away. And I think me spending that time with him, as well as me going to the sentencing of the first federal trial, and I was there every day for the second trial, really, really helped. And the trust of not only Christian, but his lawyer, Steve Haney, as well. And it's just interesting just being there. You know, it's like experiencing this whole crazy trial together, you know? You form some sort of, I don't know, shared experience, you know. If something crazy happened in the courtroom and they go to a lunch break, you know, they talk about it with themselves, but I'm right there as well, you know. So it was interesting to be able to kind of talk about what was happening in the case all together. I think that helped a lot as far as trust for Christian and for Steve Haney.
What about connecting with his parents? I think of all the interviews in the film, them two sitting there and I mean, especially when they get emotional at the end, I'm curious. Obviously, Christian must have given the voucher of approval, but what did it mean to you to be able to sit down with them and get the story of his brother and so much about the family.
Yeah, the family was crucial, and Lou and Trish, his mom and dad, are absolutely amazing people, and they're amazing on camera, and we needed them. We needed them desperately. And I think, I don't want to speak for them, but I would assume, I could be wrong, but I think they were way more leery of me than Christian. And we went and had dinner together in New York when they came up for his sentencing. That was the first time I met them in the first trial. And we had a nice long dinner and talked about everything. But I think they were actually pretty wary to go on camera. And I think had Christian not probably told them, look, like, you can trust him, you know, everything's cool, I don't know if they would have done it. So I didn't have the time to kind of build that rapport with Lou and Trish like I did with Christian. So he definitely helped. And I think, again, Steve Haney was really good friends with Lou for years and years. So I think that helped as well. But they were crucial. They were absolutely crucial, and they are fantastic in the documentary and great people. So we definitely needed that, and I'm very grateful that we did get those interviews.
Obviously, you're not going to get the ability to chit-chat with the FBI. So I've got to ask, structure-wise...
I have in the past, though. That's the weird thing.
Well, go ahead and tell that story. I'd love to hear that. You know, I mean, when you in the film, it obviously says you approach them, but like, how often do you go and say, "Would you be interested?" Before they are like, "No."
Multiple times, but when they say no, it's like a deafening no. You know, there's not a lot of wiggle room there. So we interviewed the two FBI agents that interviewed Carlton Dodson and got Carlton Dodson's confession for the murder of Patrick Dennehy in disgrace. They were fantastic. I mean, working with that FBI office and those two agents were amazing. It was a really, really great experience. I interviewed the retired FBI agent that was the only person left alive that apprehended Patty Hearst. Same thing. He was amazing. So I have really positive experiences working with the FBI in the past. This was just like they completely shut it down. They wanted nothing to do with it. And I reached out, I don't know, 3 or 4 times probably to try to get them to come on camera. And not only that, just try to get some answers and some more information as to what happened with some of the agents that were working in the undercover investigation. And they absolutely refused to cooperate and refused to send anybody on camera.
So crazy. And obviously NCAA is a whole different beast as far as their ability or not ability to talk to people. I'm curious, what are your interactions with them were like?
It's the same thing. I mean, we reached out to the NCAA. We requested an interview with Mark Emmert, the president. And they said no on that. We said, you know, give us a representative, somebody, you know, to go on camera. Same thing. Let your perspective be included. We wanted it. We asked for it. We gave everybody the same opportunity to have their position given the same platform here. So it wasn't just the NCAA and the FBI. It was the Southern District of New York. It was, you know, just about every co-defendant in the case. James Gatto, the Adidas executive, Manish Sood, who was Christian's business partner that testified against him, Marty Blazer, who was the informant the whole time. I mean, some of the assistant coaches, Tony Bland, you know, June Kim, U.S. attorney for the Southern District, none of them would talk. So we had some serious challenges with getting enough people on camera. But the one thing that we had, I think, to counter that, though, was we had all of the evidence. And thousands of hours of wiretaps. And in a lot of ways, that is much more important in telling this story because it alleviates a revisionist look at what happened. We were able to put the audience on the phone with these people, so you hear their true intent, their motivations, their thinking. They have no idea they're being recorded, and you can put them in the room with some of these undercover videos that we had. So I think it actually worked better than I was initially expecting, and I think the only way it really did work is that we had that, those wiretaps and all of that evidence. Without that, I don't know if we could have done the story.
I've got to ask how you made it so suspenseful, because if one of the things I love about it is I was itching to know what's going on, what's going to happen next. And I'm kind of want you to talk a little bit about, you brought on for this project, I don't know if you personally brought them on, but like your composers, the music behind this, tell me a bit about, did that help with at least getting from scene to scene? 'Cause I felt like, A, the suspense was there, but the flow of it was, I mean, the pace was beautiful. It was wonderful.
Yeah, and I credit that all. All that credit should go to Sean McQueen, my editor, who's a fucking phenom. And our composers, Danny Bentian, Saunder. I don't want to butcher Saunder's last name. But Danny and Saunder, I think, are like, they are, in my mind, they're the two best composers working today in television or film. I mean, they did the score for Enemy. They do American Gods. They do Ozark. They do, I think, Fear the Walking Dead. They did the score for the HBO miniseries The Outsider, which, I mean, that music. What they're able to do and what they did in this scheme is their music builds, and it builds in a really subtle way, to where it keeps the pacing going, but it doesn't distract from the content. So it elevates it without distracting, which is exactly what you want. And they are, I mean, they are brilliant. They are masterful at doing that. And I think when they did the scheme, at that time, I think Danny was in LA and Saunder was in New York, so they were doing it remotely and recording all this stuff. I mean, I don't know how, their process is insane. But what they were bringing back to us, what they were delivering during the cut, just consistently blew me away. And it absolutely heightens and elevates all of the content, all of the suspense. Tonally, it really, really shapes the doc. And then the other thing is, my editor is just unbelievable. Sean McQueenie is an absolutely brilliant editor. And especially considering that we are constantly taking on insanely complex and convoluted stories. So if you can have an editor that can break that down and lay it out in a way that is digestible for the audience, I mean, that is an unbelievably difficult feat, and Sean does it over and over and over again for me.
Who came up with the idea of bookending it with the question of, did you do anything wrong, Christian?
I think it was me, but you know what? Sean and I pretty much talk about everything. So whether it was I said, hey, try this, or he said, hey, I want to do this, I mean, it's him and I work in tandem on it. I think that this came about, though, because watching the footage, he pauses. That's not an edited pause. That's a real-time him pausing that long to think about it. And I think that's what kind of caught my eye, you know. And Christian is so open about what he did. He never backs away from any of it. I was really curious to see what he would actually say on camera, you know, because he's not going to say, look, I didn't do this. He's not going to fight you on that. He's just going to fight you on, look, is this wrong, right? Did I break a law? Should, you know. Who cares if I broke this rule if we can all agree that this rule is arbitrary and stupid? So he'll debate you on the merits of something, but it was interesting that he wouldn't really shy away from, he wouldn't deny the things that he did, which makes him a very interesting person.
It made him human. It was a wonderful moment. I've got to ask, I mean, I know in the film you give us an update of what he's doing now, but is there any further updates you can give now that we've kind of, I mean, been a little bit while since you filmed, at least? I mean, the latest update for Christian or the family or anything like that?
Yeah, Christian, I mean, he has his own, he's the CEO of his own record label called Chosen Records, and he has a joint venture with Atlantic Records on that. I know he signed a few more artists, and they've come out with some music, and he's doing all of this while he's waiting to find out what's going to happen with his two appeals. So he hasn't stopped moving, I think Christian's going to be fine. You know, we'll see what happens with these appeals, but if he loses his appeals, he's going to be in federal prison for 18 months, and he'd have to serve 85% of that sentence, which is insane. So, I know he's hoping that doesn't happen, but in the meantime, he's not slowing down. He's moving right along with his record label. By the way, he has no experience in music, none whatsoever. None whatsoever. There's a story about that we couldn't fit into the documentary for time reasons, but when he got out of jail, right, when he was first arrested, and then he ends up flying home to his parents' house, he was incredibly depressed. His name was everywhere. He struck through the mud, right? He's this guy that was this terrible person that was brought down in the FBI investigation. So he's sitting in his parents', basement, kind of depressed, and he's thinking, what can I do next? So what he ends up doing is he starts buying books on the record industry. So his mom told me he would read a book every day, and then another book would come in the mail, and another book, and another book. So he started reading all of these books by these record label CEOs and these music moguls, and he taught himself the industry. And then wrote a business plan and came up with it in his parents' basement while he was waiting to go to trial for his first federal case. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
The guy is seriously, he's a cross between Ferris Bueller and Frank Abagnale Jr. from Catch Me If You Can.
He really is
amazing.
He's
super smart and can just look at a situation and go, okay, here's the problem. I'm going to find a solution here. It's really, really impressive.
I think that's a selling point for the doc right there, is just how cool he is, because that does come across so well. It's not an arrogance. You're right. It's a positive bravado. Maybe it's you like people who can do that, because the guts to do that must be insane.
Yeah, his confidence, I think, is attractive. You know. Anybody that's confident, but he's also very intelligent, which is very helpful, and he's an incredibly hard worker. He will grind it out and make something happen. And I think all of those are obviously positive and attractive traits, and it all helps in the charisma that he holds.
So I'll do a couple quick hit questions for you. What's the experience of winning an Emmy like?
That was surreal, man. That was totally surreal, unexpected. I've been to two ceremonies. We got nominated for a Newton Documentary Emmy for High Profits, and we didn't win. But that was just crazy because I was sitting next to Steve James, which I was freaking out, you know. And I'd actually interviewed him before, for something I did for PBS in Austin, and I was too afraid to even say hello to him and be like, hey, remember, I was the guy, I interviewed you. But yeah, I mean, to sit, even sitting next to a legend like Steve James was crazy. So when we got nominated for Disgraced, I didn't think we were going to win. We had been nominated for two awards, and we lost the first one, and then the last one was, best outstanding sports documentary or something like that. And when they said our name, it's just it's one of those weird moments where time kind of freezes, and I didn't know what I was saying. I totally blacked out kind of up there, you know. I'm sure I stumbled and fumbled through it like a moron. I kind of came to about 10 minutes later and just thought, what the hell just happened? And my God, what did I say? Did I say something stupid? Did I forget somebody? And then we had a really great party afterwards. Drank a lot of old fashions, so it was a blast.
Old fashions, yeah. And things don't change with you. I love that you brought up Steve James. One of my all-time favorite interviews I've ever gotten to do is with Steve. I mean, I think like you, Hoop Dreams changed our life as far as understanding what a documentary is.
Hoop Dreams is groundbreaking.
Yeah, changed the whole face of documentary. As far as your day-to-day approach, I know it's kind of tough in these times, but I know you're a hard worker. Tell me, you know, what when you go into work, you know, are you a morning guy, a late night guy? I mean, how do you approach work?
I'm definitely more a morning person. I think, you know, that's where, for me, I think we get the most creative and important things done in the morning. So I am, I'm always amped up. I've injected myself into a massively unhealthy amount of caffeine in the morning, and then it's just right, all right, let's get into this right away. And it, for me, the morning is always the most productive hours. We're at Bathbridge. It's a, you know, it's a very collaborative experience, and, you know, when no matter what stage of the project we're in, there's a million different decisions to be made, a million creative decisions, a million technical decisions, and it's never dull, Gotti.
You know, all these years I've known you, I've never really thought you were intelligent enough to read a book, but I'll ask a question about you reading. No, I'm just kidding. I know you're a smart guy. Any books you've read recently? Anything you, what's in your little library list or whatever you have?
Man, I've read a bunch, and they're all based on, it's all around projects that we're doing. So I'm trying to think of the last one that I read that was not like a research portion of a project that I can't discuss just yet. God, let me think. I'm telling you, man, I think like with every, I think I read three with Patty Hearst. That's one with Disgraced. That's a tough one, dude.
Well, I'll give you another
one. There's I think six between these next two projects that we're developing that I can't really discuss yet.
Well, I won't dive into that. So I'll switch up the question then. How do you unwind from your work? Are you a TV guy? I know you're a music guy. You love music, but I'm curious. How do you unwind?
Yeah, I would say happy hour, old fashioned music, and yeah, definitely TV and movies. Probably lately more TV than movies. You know, the content, the quality of these scripted series now are just so unbelievably amazing. You know, like I just watched the latest episode of Better Call Saul.
Oh, yeah.
Which was mind-blowing, dude. Mind-blowing. That show is so underrated. I think that's the best show on television right now. There's nothing like it. The way that they shoot that show, the way they edit it, their patience and their pacing, I mean, that show, I think, right now in my mind, totally stands alone. And, God, I think I finished Ozark Season 3 in 2 days. It's because of the quarantine, you know, but, yeah, there's so many good shows. There's so many good documentaries being made. I mean, I'm watching probably multiple a week, you know. I would say that.
Yeah.
Drinking. Watching other people's work, yeah, that helps relax me.
As far as being a family man, how has being a father impacted you?
Man, it's in every way imaginable, really. And you know what? I think the balance of work life and home life is something that I struggle with. I haven't figured out that balance yet, that magic formula. I know, you know, a lot of other people the same way. But I will say how it's impacted my work is I'm much more selective on projects that we're going to do because I know how long we're going to be working on it. I know how difficult the work is going to be, and I don't want to spend 2 years of my life that's going to take me away from my wife and my kids on something that I'm not going to be proud of or that I don't give a shit about at the end of the day. So it definitely has informed my, or it has made me more selective. I think I was pretty selective to begin with, but I think year after year, I get more and more selective just because unless I love the story and it's going to be worth the time. Like I spent over 2 months last year in New York on working on the scheme. So 2 months out of the year, just on that project, not including the other projects we had, away from my wife and kids. So it's difficult and the story just has to be, it's got to be worth it, you know? And when they're older, and I can finally show them some of this stuff. I can say, all right, this is why I missed this birthday. Mm. you can understand now, you know.
It's the old Dave Chappelle bit. The guy that brings us gifts every once in a while.
Exactly. Yep.
Exactly. Well, I'll end it with something fun. What's wrong with your Houston Texans, man? Are they just giving away everybody?
Dude, they're, you know, I don't know. Is this like a podcast, dude? Are you writing this? How is this working?
Oh, no, this is going to be all one interview. All of this will go in as one audio file of greatness for you.
Okay, so it's audio.
Yeah.
See, I'm just saying, like, can I cuss? What's the rules here, Gotti?
We're on the internet. You've cussed quite a bit on this interview, so don't worry now.
All right, I'm sorry, man. Yeah, it's hard for me to communicate without throwing in there some pejoratives, but yeah, I don't know what the fuck they're doing, man. I am embarrassed to be a Texans fan. I don't think I'll ever be able to forgive the organization or Bill O'Brien for trading DeAndre Hopkins away. My kid, when I told him, I had to explain that Hopkins is one of his favorite players, that he had been traded. My son goes, Dad, I don't think the Texans like to win. I'm like, he gets it. He gets it. Why can't they get it? Why can't O'Brien get it? Why can't the McNair family get it? I don't understand what they're doing. You know? But, I mean, they're still not the Cowboys. So, that's something that you can say. It's positive. It's not like Dak Prescott, man. He's upset about a franchise tag worth $27 million next year.
It's tough, you know? It's tough to you know, be a rich kid. I don't know. I can't explain things.
But, that guy, man.
Yeah, he likes...
Seriously, $27 million, you're upset you're not going to even participate in virtual workouts, and then you're going to have a party during the pandemic as well. Come on, buddy. Be better than that.
All right, last question, Pat. This is a serious one. This is for all the marbles. Do you get a free subscription from HBO prior to the pandemic because of you working on Docs, or do you have to pay for it?
No. No, I did not. I have to pay for it. Yeah. Maybe if we do another project with them, I'll work that into the deal.
I'm 100% sure that Jonathan Nolan doesn't pay for his HBO, but Pat Condalas does. I think that's pretty funny.
There's no glamour in unscripted content, Gotti. Everybody should understand that. I make documentaries and documentary series, man. You know, I'm sure my budget on some of these things are smaller than catering budgets for Westworld. You know, you got to put it into perspective.
Literally, I'm going to push stop. That's the end of the interview, Pat.